last time you heard 50 degrees on February 27th, huh? It's been a while, folks. It has. Good afternoon, everybody. Happy, can I push it? Springtime. You know we're going to get bombed. March is, along with January, the snowiest months of the year in Minnesota. So Mother Nature may give us a whack. But boy, this is beautiful today. Stan Turner with you here. Thank you so much. Kyle's with us. Kyle, I saw my first motorcycle out on the highway this morning.
Oh, yeah?
Here, yeah. So that's a harbinger of something good, I think, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good weather. Guy looked cold, though. The driver really looked cold. He was wearing a hat like yours, big, heavy wool job. And let's see, I saw a guy out front here in downtown Stillwater in a T-shirt. So, you know, yeah, looks for real. We're at 50 degrees already, 57 degrees, 57. If we do that, that smashing sound you hear is a record being broken, and that means we'll set a new one if we get to 57 degrees today. I think 54 is the standing record for this date. So there you go, all about the weather, 12:07 right now. Thanks for being with us. As we always endeavor to do, we try to bring you a program on this show here that will inform you and entertain you, and we do believe we have the ingredients necessary to make that happen this noon. You know, I've always been drawn to early rock and roll guitar music. 50s and 60s groups, you know, like the Fireballs and the Ventures, great guitar slingers in those bands. The Ventures, they had some big hits back in the day. Remember Walk, Don't Run? Perfidia was another one. The Hawaii Five-O theme. Yeah, the Ventures did that one. And they had a catchy, albeit obscure number with a very strange title. It's called Gandhi Dancer. Kyle, let's play a little bit of it here. Yeah, the Ventures from Seattle, Washington, playing Gandhi Dancer. So, ha! That begs the question, what does Gandhi Dancer mean? What or who is a Gandhi Dancer? Well, I eventually found out and put the term aside because it's rarely, if ever, used. Until now, that is. A forthcoming book about the long-gone Skid Row in downtown Minneapolis makes liberal use of the term Gandhi Dancer, or Gandhis, as the term is sometimes used. This is a fascinating story. It's a true story of that seamy, sleazy, scuzzy part of Minneapolis that was crawling with Gandhi Dancers and their human parasites. The story is told through the lens, figurative as well as literal, of a bar and flophouse operator in Minneapolis Skid Row. That man's memories and his pictures, both still photos and moving pictures, bring back to life this sad and sordid chapter of those guys and some gals who staggered through life and often into death in that alcohol-sodden district we call Skid Row. We have the author of this new book with us in studio this noon. James Eli Schiffer titles his book, The King of Skid Row, John Basich and the Twilight Years of Old Minneapolis. James, welcome to the show.
Stan, thank you so much. It is awesome to be here.
Very nice to have you, sir. It's hard for me to say. I can't say I enjoy the book because it's just full of sadness and violence and all of it. It is a fascinating story, a book that needed to be written,
thank
and I'm
you.
So glad. And you've done it so well. Congratulations.
Thank
on
you very,
very much.
It's right? Great
wow.
opportunity.
Well, no book like this exists right now. I mean, before we plunge on and get into it, Gandhi Dancer, we better define our terms here.
Well, you know, Gandhi Dancer is a term to refer to a railroad worker.
Yeah.
Now, that's about all we know. There's a Gandhi Dancer trail in Wisconsin that's a rail trail, so that would speak to that. I tried to find out the origin of this name, and the closest anybody could come was the idea that they were dancing on the rails. It was a certain sort of motion they had to do, but nobody really knows.
You can hear that motion in the excerpt from the Ventures song there a little bit.
And thank you for introducing me to the Ventures song, because I never
knew
heard
about
that
it
before.
Did you?
I knew I'd learned something today.
The Ventures and I are the only people who know about that song, I think so. In the U.S., a Gandhi Dancer, we don't want to belabor this, but early section crews on the railroad are often made up of recent immigrants. This is way back in the day, late 19th century. And ethnic minorities also who vied for steady work despite poor wages and working conditions and hard physical labor. So, Gandhi Dancer, there we go, to find it. Yeah, let's talk about you. You are you're with the Star Tribune, aren't
I
you?
I am.
Huh? Yep.
I'm an editor and a columnist. I edit our Watchdog and Data team, which does a lot of investigative work. And I write a column on Sundays called Full Disclosure, which is about, oh, such weighty topics as government secrecy, transparency, public records, scams, and just strange stories I come across.
Nothing we want to know about, huh?
Everything
we want to know.
Only on Sundays.
Only on Sundays. Well, that sounds like a good song. Well, how did you come to write this book? This is an amazing tome here, this book called The King of Skid Row, John Bassich and the Twilight Years of Old Minneapolis.
Well, I got to give a shout out here to a friend of mine, Eric Johnson, who introduced me to this film that Johnny made and a company documentary that came out on TBT back in 1998. And he gave me a VHS tape. Remember those?
I do.
Yeah.
You say Johnny. We got to get our names set here now. We're talking about Johnny.
John Bassich.
We're going to call him Johnny Rex.
Johnny Rex, King of Skid Row.
That was his alias. To avoid confusion, why don't we just say Johnny Rex?
Johnny Rex.
So Johnny Rex had this movie.
He made these films. They were 16-millimeter films, silent. And he used to show them to the many civic clubs he was part of.
And what years did he make these?
He made these from the late 1950s to the early 1960s.
Okay.
And he would broadcast. I mean, he would use these with a projector and would show them to the many groups he was in. Somebody figured out that he could do a voiceover for it, which he did in the mid 80s. And then that became kind of a cult favorite around town, I think. A documentary filmmaker made a film about Johnny Rex to accompany that. It was broadcast on TPT in 1998. That was before I lived here. And ended up with a it was broadcast year after year. It was quite popular. And then I moved to town in 2005. I meet Eric. Eric gives me this tape. He says, "You got to see this. You got
to
see this."
Just kind of a non sequitur. Here, James. Here's something you want. You're new to town.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Here's something that deals with.
Well, he and I share this interest in dive bars.
Dive bars, huh?
Excuse me. Yeah, dive bars. Yeah, of which there are fewer and fewer, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So he said, "You know, you got to see this. This will tell you about Minneapolis, an era of Minneapolis that is completely gone."
Right.
Which is just fascinating, and I became obsessed with it.
Right. It's easy to become obsessed with it. I saw when I was with Channel 5 News, somebody in the newsroom had a copy of this. I saw an excerpt, and two vagrants, obviously drunk guys, are pulling each other's noses and laughing, and it looked like they were really exerting some muscle, too. It was painful just to watch it, not only bizarre, but painful. So, yeah, I saw a bit of it, and at once comedic and also very tragic, very sad. So this guy, Johnny Rex, made these photographs, had a 16-millimeter Bell & Howell,
yes,
and recorded this, also in still photographs.
Yes.
We should note that Johnny Rex was a creature of Skid Row in Minneapolis. He owned a hotel, a flea bag hotel, as we might call it, cage hotel. We'll define that a little later. A liquor store, Rex Liquors, and the Sourdough Bar. Okay?
Yes.
But let's go back and tell us a little bit about the history of Johnny Rex.
Well, Johnny Rex was a son of immigrants from Eastern Europe. Grew up in the Superior, Wisconsin, Duluth, Twin Ports area. His family moved to St. Paul in the 1920s. Dad was a bootlegger and real estate. The bootlegger turned real estate speculator after the end of Prohibition. And Johnny Rex was interested in business, sort of following in his father's footsteps. Served from the beginning, even before the World War II, the U.S. was pulled into World War II. Johnny Rex was served in the Army for, I believe, 6 years, 5 to 6 years. Saw action in Eastern Europe, liberated a concentration camp as a tank commander. Moved back to, came back stateside and kind of didn't know what to do with himself. And ended up running a restaurant for a short time, but landed in Skid Row selling liquor, which would not seem to be a great business proposition in the long term, but you got a big market for it. They're not willing to pay a lot for it, but there are certainly people willing to buy it.
Well, he found the chemistry, literally and figuratively, didn't he? Skid Row, Minneapolis. Why don't you define its geographical? Where was it?
Well, that's the thing. This is I've led tours for Preserve Minneapolis, and I'm going to be doing some this summer as well for the Star Tribune, of this neighborhood, and you wouldn't know there was Skid Row there. It is the heart of it was where Washington, Nicollet, and Hennepin Avenues come together. There's an insurance headquarters there now, and on one corner is a Whole Foods market. This shows you how far it's come from Skid Row.
Mm-hmm.
That was the epicenter of the old Skid Row. It was the oldest part of the city. It was where the railroad stations were, and the City Hall used to be there. And those who remember the Nicollet Hotel, because that lasted a little longer, that was kind of right on the edge of it as well. Mm-hmm. So that was the oldest part of Minneapolis. There was a several blocks full of 19th century sort of commercial buildings, which had been Skid Row for more than 50 years.
Mm-hmm. When did it go on the skids? When did that area become a magnet for people down and out, drunks and drifters?
Well,
and
it really started as a migrant seasonal labor pool. So that was the place where people would go when they were looking for work in the pineries up north, logging, mm-hmm. Looking for jobs on the railroad. Looking for jobs in farms, they would come to that neighborhood, stay in these cheap hotels, and wait to be hired and shipped out to the hinterlands. And then when they would make their money, they'd come back and spend it all.
Yeah, some of them railroad workers, they'd get their pension checks.
Yep.
What was it called? Johnny Rickcomb,
the rocking chair.
That was very common.
He loved,
he and his fellow merchants loved to get a hold of those pension checks, didn't they?
Oh, sure. Well, it was a vertically integrated enterprise. You know, he'd accept that, he'd get the checks, he'd cash them, he'd pay himself out of for the cost of the rooms and deduct it for other things as well. You asked when it started to go downhill.
Right.
It almost immediately, late 19th century, the city was already getting concerned about it because a lot of the institutions of the city were moving out of that neighborhood into newer buildings, and it was just already starting to kind of fall apart.
So into that vacuum, maybe prostitution and bootlegging and everything.
Oh, well, sure. Well, it was Minneapolis had this unusual system for regulating alcohol, which is probably somewhat of a reflection of their Scandinavian heritage. And having lived in Sweden, I can tell you there's a very troubled relationship with alcohol.
And being of Scandinavian heritage, I've heard about that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So they drew lines around certain parts of the city, and they said outside of these lines you cannot serve liquor, you cannot sell liquor. But everything inside those lines was kind of a free-for-all. And the Gateway District, otherwise known as the Lower Loop, Skid Row was one of those places where there were liquor stores and bars and beer parlors.
Strip joints, the whole
thing. Oh, everything. Everything, the sort of the vices of the city concentrated in one neighborhood.
Right there. As a kid, I remember, I grew up in St. Louis Park, and as a very, very small boy, my father one night was driving the family in the old automobile there down Washington Avenue. It was at night. And the place, James, I tell you, it looked like the Midway at the State Fair. I've never seen such a dazzling display of neon lights, gaudy as it was. But for a little kid, it was exciting. I remember these palm trees going, these neon palm trees. The Persian palms, I guess that was.
Oh, yes.
Right? A strip joint, I guess. They're of a higher ranking, apparently. That's a relative term. Yeah. But just amazing. And it was just gaga. And a couple weeks later, we were driving down there in daylight, and it looked like an entirely different universe. I mean, it was just ugly, gray, brown and sleazy and
falling apart
just like the people who inhabited the area. So that was my taste, and it's indelibly inscribed in my memory. It's just amazing. So I did see a little bit of it before I got torn down. This is amazing. James Eli Schiffer, his book coming out. In fact, it's due for publication from University of Minnesota Press in April, but I understand it's already out there.
It appears that Amazon will sell you a copy if you want to buy it.
Okay, The King of Skid Row. That is the name of the book. It's 12:20 right now. We have already 50 degrees, shooting for a record high today of 57. Back with James Eli Schiffer and the King of Skid Row in Minneapolis right after this. At the Stan Turner Show, we love good stories, and there's no better place to find them than Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Valley Bookseller is an independent bookstore with knowledgeable and friendly staff who love books. Tell them what you like to read, and they'll make terrific recommendations just for you. Also, discover one of the finest children's collections in the entire Twin Cities. Valley Bookseller. Great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater. Online at valleybookseller.com.
Hymies Haberdashery presents The Hymies Oath. On my honor, I will dress my best, be clean in my speech and actions, live my life honestly, take care of my body for good build and fit, to help keep my country strong by supporting local merchants. Through the words and actions of my haberdasher, I will trust.
So, gentlemen, will you take the Jaime's oath? Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street, downtown St. Paul, at Jaime's.com.
Back in the late 1800s, if your brewery burned to the ground, it usually meant you were out of business for good. But Joseph Wolf rebuilt his brewery and continued brewing his beer until Prohibition hit. And a 93-year dry spell isn't stopping great-granddaughters Pat and Kathy from bringing it back. Go to wolfbrewing.com, click on Beer Finder so you can bring it back to your home. Ask for Wolf's, Stillwater's original craft beer. Wolf Brewing Company, Stillwater, Minnesota.
Guten Tag, this is Stan Turner, and I would like to personally invite you to join me on a tour of the Alpine highlights of Austria and Germany this September. We'll stay in quaint Austrian and Bavarian villages. We'll visit Innsbruck as a local guide introduces us to the old town and the Golden Dachl. We'll explore Neuschwanstein Castle, Walt Disney's inspiration for Cinderella's castle. And what would a fall trip to Bavaria be without partaking in Oktoberfest? We'll visit Munich and join in on one of the world's largest festivals, Oktoberfest. These are just a few of the highlights of our 8-day, 7-night tour of the Alpine highlights of Austria and Germany. Airfare, transportation, and daily breakfast and dinner are included. However, seating is limited. To join me, please call Defined Destinations at 651-398-9358. That's 651-398-9358 or online at defineddestinations.com.
Back we are. It's 1223 right now. Unbelievable weather. 50. We got to believe it, though, because it's true. The thermometer is reading 50 degrees in the Twin Cities today. And we may shatter the standing record of 54 degrees, I think it is, with a high today in the upper 50s, maybe around 57. Hey, let's go for 60. What do you say? We are going for a look deep inside a brand new book called The King of Skid Row. We're talking about Minneapolis Skid Row. The author, James Eli Schiffer, is with us. A story with the centerpiece of a guy named Johnny Rex, who owned a hotel, a flea bag hotel, one of those flop houses. Also owned a place called Rex Liquors and Sourdough Bar, where they rang the bell for free drinks there behind the bar.
Once in a while.
This is all back in the 50s, early 60s, before the place got bulldozed. Mm-hmm. This amazing social history. James, thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
Why don't you read a little excerpt from your book here about Skid Row?
Okay. Not many men head to Skid Row to make it big. This was where lives petered out. For decades, the Gateway District had served as the hub for men seeking seasonal labor in the railroads, farms, and pine forests of the upper Midwest. By the 1950s, those jobs were disappearing, and the Gateway District had assumed an air of inertia and slow decay. People from other parts of town only visited the place after dark to finish off their weekend binges with cheap nightcaps or to take in a floor show at the Persian Palms. Aside from the shopkeepers and warehouse owners who could not afford to operate anywhere else, and the merchants who took the old men's pension money in return for booze, upstanding Minneapolis residents viewed people who wore secondhand suits and lived in stinking flop houses as distasteful and parasitic.
The merchants you write there who took the pension checks of the people who stayed in their dumps, huh? Guys like Johnny Rex, huh? He was one of those, kind of a parasite in a way.
Well, huh? I mean, you know, that was one description. You could also...
I'm not using it. Some people have used
true,
it.
True, that's true, true. I think he was a morally complex figure.
How diplomatic of you.
Yes, well, I mean, he was part of a sustaining a community, and it was a community that the rest of Minneapolis was eager to see dispersed and sent sure. somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But they were a community, and I think it has to be recognized that they were men who were part of the city's history, and that, you know, they chose in a lot of cases mm-hmm. to live in this place, and that they were not disposable.
Or by their addictions, they wound up there.
True.
There was no safety net for people back then.
And this would have been the equivalent of it. And
some safety net, a lot of holes in it.
Well, it was a kind of safety net that a lot of the rest of the city, and really, I mean, there were skid rows in many cities, were just viewed as a blight, and that the place they were living was the cause. If they just got rid of it, these guys would go away and they wouldn't have these problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go away. Well, to another part of the city.
That was their fear.
James Schiffer, take us inside some of these places, these dens of iniquity, if they might be. The Persian Palms, I've mentioned and you have mentioned. Tell us about that. That was on Washington Avenue.
It was on Washington Avenue, I believe it was in the 100 block of Washington Avenue. And it was sort of the kind of the most notorious business in Skid Row. It was owned by a Russian immigrant by the name of Harry Small, and was a famous for its, I believe, 3 floor shows daily, a strip club. But it sort of depends on who you asked. It was a destination.
isn't everything?
Was it classy or was it not classy? I guess it really depends on your feeling. There was a council member who called it one of the raunchiest operations in town. But
now, how would he know?
Well, exactly. They were sort of afraid or maybe unhappy it wasn't showing up anywhere else when they got rid of it. But it did seem to disappear with the demolition of Skid Row. It was not moved somewhere else. Unlike the Gay 90s, which was on Washington Avenue and kind of moved around the corner.
And still there, isn't it?
Still there.
Back to the Persian Palms. If a guy walked in that joint, say in 1957 or 58, even if he's reasonably well-dressed, he's going to go up to the bar, but suddenly he's got company.
Yes, the B-girls.
B-girls.
The B-girls.
What's the B stand for?
Bar.
Bar, okay.
Bar. And I mean, that's my understanding. I'm sure you can substitute any word you want.
Sure. What, they must have had some purpose.
Their purpose is a lot of times they were working in league with the bar. And so they would get encourage this newcomer to drink and buy them a drink, and then there'd be a cut of that income, you know, to the B girls who would see to be hanging on your back.
Every guy wants to be a big shot, so he's going to say, "Sure, I'll buy you a drink."
Now, there's a wonderful. I don't have this anecdote in my book, but it's a wonderful anecdote. You know, the University of Minnesota sociology department dispatched all of these students in disguise as pretending that they were Skid Row residents to investigate and research the conditions on Skid Row. And one of them reported that he went into it could have been the Persian Palms, I don't remember if it was, but a B-girl appeared, and the bartender didn't even ask and poured her a drink. And then she asked, "You're buying me a drink."
We're a little out of sequence there.
And he said, and the student said, "I'm broke. I don't have anything."
Oh.
And then the bartender picked up the drink and dumped it back in the bottle.
Wow. Wow. Now that's America for you.
Yes.
Skid Row,
and that was the University of Minnesota duly recorded that incident, and it's now sort of part of the research annals.
I'll tell you another one is this. A bartender at the Persian Palms, he was confronted with a mayor from Elk River who had been out in the town the night before.
Yes.
And the guy came in to settle up his account at the Persian Palms and tell us what happened. The then mayor, not the current mayor. We're talking about a long time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're talking back in the 50s. Okay, this legendary thing where
the mayor goes to settle up his account.
He writes a check.
To the joint, the bartender looks at it.
It looks at it and says it's not
illegible, right?
It's illegible. I can't take it. Crumples it up, throws it away. So apparently the mayor was unperturbed by this. Had more than one check with him. Wrote another one, and then the proprietor took the other one that had been crumpled up.
When the guy left,
cleaned it up, ironed it or something, deposited them both.
Deposited them both.
That's right.
The game was on, wasn't
it? That's right.
And you mentioned Harry Small, who ran the joint.
Yes.
He had a little office in the back of the Persian Palms. What went on there?
Well, he kept a large quantity of cash, and that was Johnny Rex once saw it back there, and he indicated that he kept a significant amount of money there in order to pay off the police. Should they be, that was a requirement as well. The police were benefiting from the large cash economy. There was some theft that happened as well from Mr. Small's safe. And in fact, I did find a news article from years ago that described him being tied up and a large amount of cash being removed.
How much?
You know,
was it $400,000?
Well, I don't believe it said it was quite that much.
Okay,
but you know,
he had a lot of greenbacks around there, though, didn't he?
He did. Yeah. Apparently, he did. And there was a practice called skimming, in which they would take a certain amount off the top that they wouldn't pay taxes on. And that was apparently a source of a large amount of money for some of these. They would report much less income than they actually were getting.
Oh, man. So Johnny Rex is taking all this in, and he's operating his own institutions there.
Yes.
A hotel called the Victor Hotel.
The Victor Hotel.
Then Rex Liquors, a bottle shop.
Yes.
And then his bar, his saloon, the Sourdough Bar.
Yes.
James Schiffer, take us inside the Victor Hotel, a so-called cage hotel.
Yes. Now, you need to know a little about cage hotels here. Cage hotels were... There was no hotel that was probably built as a cage hotel. These were converted from other... warehouse lofts generally, and they build a bunch of partitions out of tin and plywood.
That was your wall.
That was your wall, and there'd be a sort of a thin door, and then there was no roof. There was just chicken wire. And wire.
In your room, you look up to the ceiling, and it's chicken wire?
It's chicken wire, and there's usually a bare bulb hanging through. And this, the chicken wire was there for good air circulation. But it also prevented people from coming in and stealing your stuff, which was a constant in Skid Row. It's just there was constantly your belongings were constantly being pilfered, and you were pilfering other people's belongings.
How big was the room, typically?
You know, the rooms, it was 6x6 in that area. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, just enough room for a bed, maybe a chair.
No sink? No running water?
Oh, no.
Certainly no bathroom.
No. It's a communal bathroom, and a terrible shortage of plumbing as well.
Oh.
So you had very, very thin walls. You might have a nail to hang your jacket on. You tucked your shoes under your bed. And there was it was privacy. There was privacy, but it was...
of a kind.
Yeah. I mean, it was sort of the most minimal definition of housing.
Yeah.
But it was your private room.
And some guys lived there for years, didn't they?
30-plus years.
Really?
Yes.
What was the tab? How much were they paying?
Well, you could pay 50 to 75 cents a night, but it was cheaper by the week and month. Mm. You know, it was some fraction of that.
Oh, wow.
And if you paid up front, you know, it was cheaper still.
Well, so many drunks around these poor creatures. They're intoxicated so much of the time. There had to be a lot of violence going on. The clerk at the counter, if they had such a thing at these flop houses, that had to be a rough job.
They were often residents of the hotel.
Oh, they lived there
as well.
Probably
yes,
they got their cubicle for free.
They got their cubicle for free. Yeah. They might get one of the things that Johnny Rex said that he would allow his clerks to do was to bootleg. And in the post-prohibition meaning of that term was you would be able to get a case of, say, fifths of cheap wine or something and sell them individually.
Oh, my.
Which you were not supposed to do normally, but you could do that kind of under the table. That was bootlegging, and that was one of your benefits. You get to keep the proceeds of your bootlegging.
These guys, and it was guys only, supposedly.
Yes, men
no,
only.
No whip. Did they ever catch any ladies in the room?
They did, and it was the penalty was severe.
Severe.
Yes, Johnny would Johnny Rex would use his fists to enforce discipline in that.
He really did do that.
He did. Yeah. I mean, that was one of his recollections was his fisticuffs.
Yeah.
You know, it was a rough place. And if you watch his movie, there's no effort to really, there's no effort to kind of pretend that this was anything other than a very violent place where people died on the sidewalk.
Just all this drinking, these alcoholics, and they're smoking too, James.
Yes.
They're smoking, and when somebody has too much to drink, he will fall asleep on his mattress with the lighted cigarette, and...
There were fires that broke out all the time on Skid Row. People would set their mattresses on fire, and there was a great fear on the city leaders that there would be an enormous blaze that would take the whole thing down. And I think maybe some of them kind of wanted that to happen.
Yeah.
But amazingly, it never did happen to the extent that they thought it would.
That's Johnny Rex's Victor Hotel, cage hotel, flop house, flea bag, call it what you will. Let's take us down to Johnny Rex's bar called the Sourdough Bar, just a couple of staggering steps away from the hotel.
Right around the corner.
So we walk into the Sourdough. First of all, what do we see on the outside in the way of signage?
Well, it says Sourdough Bar, Ketchikan, Alaska.
What's that got to do with it?
Well, Johnny Rex's brother-in-law And the name that he took his bar from, there is a sourdough bar that exists to this day in Ketchikan, Alaska. So that was the earlier one. Okay. And that's where that came from. He obviously wanted to, speak to that sort of frontier feeling of the sourdough, and that's where that came from. And it had these wonderful sort of neon marquees with two arrows pointing down,
lest you miss the entrance,
yes,
right?
And there was a giant foaming sort of goblet of beer on the front and a big 10. And the 10 was the 10 cents. That was the permanent price for that beer.
Inside the sourdough bar, hardly one of Minneapolis' smarter clubs,
right,
you would be confronted with a long wooden bar.
Yes.
Pink plastic seating, is that right?
Yes, easy to wipe up spills.
And what else went on in there?
Well, it was...
there was a bell behind the bar, wasn't there? You could ring a bell?
Yes, there was the bell that was, it was sort of a ship's bell. And if the bell rang, that meant the drinks were on somebody.
Not necessarily.
And so people would flood in from outside, and it was
you could hear the bell outside.
You could hear the bell. Everybody listened for the bell. It had a Pavlovian response.
And Johnny would sometimes, once in a while, ring the bell himself.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, Certainly on the last night back in 1961, bell was ringing all night.
Yeah, yeah. And his beer glasses. Johnny was serving beer in what he called, or what appeared to be, 12-ounce beer glasses.
Yes, but they had a little sort of thing in the bottom where they only held 8 ounces.
So he was bilking his customers.
But he also, he had this very sort of interesting view of what his responsibility was towards his
sympathy towards some of them?
He did. He loved his guys. That's why he took their pictures. They were sort
he
of
took their money,
his
too,
family.
Didn't he?
He took their money.
Tell us about the pictures. He took a lot of pictures of them. And this gets weird. He takes photographs of the people he's exploiting as well as serving, right?
True. And he took snapshots of all of them. And he would pin them to the wall. And so that you'd see within his pictures, he'd take pictures subsequently, and you'd see all the pictures of the guys who were there before.
Kind of a rogues gallery.
Exactly. Huh? And I asked him, and I kind of got different answers every time I asked him about why he did that.
And what was his answer? Some of his answers, they changed all the
time.
The
most sort of mercenary ones were that he needed a record of these guys in case he needed to sort of track them down in the future and show them to people and say, hey, this guy owes me $50. He's down in Chicago. Where is he? He liked to keep a good relations with the police. And then the police would come in and say, hey, we found this guy floating in the river. Can we look at your photo album and see whether he's one of yours? So that was another reason. But I really feel like they were sort of his family album in a way. Mm-hmm. He really did feel sympathy towards these guys.
Especially this young, youngish, good-looking kid, Hollywood handsome.
Yes.
A transient who was the guy was so hopelessly lost in booze that, it appeared that he would not live long, which he didn't. But Johnny Rex took a shine to him. A lot of people did.
Yes. Yes, he was Johnny told me this story many times, and I talked to Johnny Rex I interviewed him for approximately the better part of 3 years, not permanently during that time, or constantly, but he told me that story several times, and I think it really spoke to him. He was a young guy, and most of the people on Skid Row were not young. This guy was young. He was a veteran. Johnny really identified with his military service, but this young man, whose name he didn't even remember, had a terrible drinking problem. And Johnny Rex tried to get him to stop, tried to get him to quit. He ended up in the hospital, and he was such a apparently handsome fellow that Johnny Rex would find the nurses sort of flitting around him, watching him. And they released him, and the young man came back to the flophouse and said, give me my money. Johnny Rex said, so I can't give you your money. You're just going to drink it up. But he couldn't stop him. Mm-hmm. And he ended up dead. And I think the reason he told that story so many times is he kind of realized at that point that it was just, this was just, he couldn't do this anymore.
Johnny had to be getting a belly full of this stuff by that time.
Oh, yeah. Was like he would see lives destroyed.
Well, yeah, but he kind of, in a way, let's just have the story tell itself here, because Johnny Rex, this guy who felt such compassion for the dying, handsome young man, one of his tenants, actually paid, Johnny Rex paid some guy $5 to pose for Johnny's camera while this guy
drained an entire quart
of wine?
Muscatel wine.
An entire quart down the hatch and
yes.
One gulp.
It's the most indelible image from the film.
It's in your book.
Yes.
You've got a still from your book.
It is the one that everyone remembers.
A quart, I don't know what the alcohol content would be.
I don't know.
Not, we're talking about a small, we're talking a quart of wine.
A quart of anything.
They'll kill you.
A quart of anything.
That's fatal.
I don't know. I've never tried it.
Well, nor have I, nor will we.
Okay.
But again, Johnny told you that not only did the guy down one, did he drain one quart?
You don't know the proximity in the movie of how, but I mean, he walks away.
Do you see him drowning, draining two bottles?
Well, but you don't see him in the same shot, so it might have happened. It is amazing. You know, he would do these stunts to get them on his film.
How about the Rex Liquor Store, Johnny's Liquor Store, which also was nearby his Fleabag
Hotel. They were all on the same block.
How convenient.
There was an interesting thing about liquor stores in the Gateway is that they were the only ones in the city where if you went in and you bought some wine, they'd say, do you want it opened?
Really?
Right on the spot. Because there was, you know.
They're going right to the alley to drink it anyway.
They're going right to the alley to drink it, pass it among themselves.
I didn't mean to laugh. I mean, just the absurdity of saying, can we open it for you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a community with a lot of problems. No question about it.
Yeah.
His liquor store, he really liked the on sale more than the off sale. It's clear the bar was the thing that was close to his heart. Well, it's just the thing he liked the most because it was so social. But it was clear a lot of the guys who lived in his flop house worked in the store. You know, it was all sort of part of the same operation.
Was it his bar? One guy figured out a way to go down to the basement where there was a drain pipe that drained off the head foam from beer. He got down there, this guy, and was sucking up that beer foam. And he noticed there was a piece of hamburger. This is in a dirty, stinking basement. And he's feeling hunger pangs. So what happened?
Well, I mean, this is, again, the sort of the degradation and the gruesomeness of Skid Row. This man actually was a resident of Johnny Rex's flop house, but this basement he was in was not part of the property. He ate some of this hamburger, which had been laced with rat poison because there were just rats running rampant through all of these buildings, and ended up dying and from this terrible incident. This is among the kind of the sort of gruesome stories that Johnny told, and he was outraged about it because the woman who sort of had done this paid no price for, you know, there was no punishment for having basically poisoned somebody.
So the barkeep, a woman, had
yes.
not
she had,
told
she had,
anybody?
No. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of desperate people on Skid Row.
Well, this is a desperate story in many ways. This is
it
an
is.
Amazing tale, a true one. The King of Skid Row by James Eli Schiffer, a story about Minneapolis's long misbegotten Skid Row. It's long gone. But
boy,
the memories persist. We'll be back with more of them in a minute.
Jaime's Haberdashery presents The Jaime's Oath.
On my honor, I will dress my best, be clean in my speech and actions, live my life honestly, take care of my body for good build and fit, to help keep my country strong by supporting local merchants. Through the words and actions of my haberdasher, I will trust.
So, gentlemen, will you take the Jaime's Oath? Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street, downtown St. Paul, at Jaime's.com.
At the Stan Turner Show, we love good stories, and there's no better place to find them than Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Valley Bookseller is an independent bookstore with knowledgeable and friendly staff who love books. Tell them what you like to read, and they'll make terrific recommendations just for you. Also, discover one of the finest children's collections in the entire Twin Cities. Valley Bookseller. Great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater. Online at valleybookseller.com.
Wolf Beer in the Bottle isn't just another bottled beer. Why? Remove the cork to find out. Yes, that's real cork. Now pour. Taste. The Strong Golden is a Belgian-style ale featuring local honey from the valley, chamomile, and rose hips. Are you ready to enjoy? Go to wolfbrewing.com and click on Beer Finder. Then ask for Wolf's, Stillwater's original craft beer. Wolf Brewing Company, Stillwater, Minnesota.
We are back. We are, in a sense, reliving the sordid days of Minneapolis's Skid Row that finally got scraped from the face of the earth in the early 1960s. But James Eli Schiffer has captured how it really was back in those terrible times with those vagrants, the drifters, the guys who fell into alcoholism, no safety net, flea bag hotel residents buying cheap booze, rot gut, they used to call it. James Eli Schiffer, there were some characters that appear in your book, as well as Johnny Rex's film of them. One was known as Moonface Mary Ann. Can you tell us about her?
Yes, well, women were kind of rare in Skid Row. It was a predominantly male environment. So part of my purpose with this book was to try to, as much as I could, kind of recover the actual names of these people. And Moonface Mary Ann was someone that Johnny Rex remembered quite well because she was a habitué of his bar particularly, and she was, you know, she served some needs of the community there. She would,
okay, I get that.
Yeah, she would spend morning till night in that bar. And when she wasn't turning tricks or using the bathroom, and that was essentially her role. She had a big personality and was
big smile too. We
big
see her in your
smile, and Johnny Rex just had such fond memories of her. And he really did, as he did for a lot of the people who lived there.
Right. We don't want to paint, and you have an accurate picture of Johnny Rex. Not a man with a heart, but sometimes kind of concealed, too. He was a conflicted man.
He was.
There does come a cleanup, as we mentioned. Skid Row finally gets cleaned up, scraped away. You know, there's an interesting word to describe an area like Skid Row. It's called the Tenderloin District.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Tenderloin has become a noun for a down-at-the-heels kind of place. I think it derives from New York City, a place you know pretty well.
San Francisco, there is still a...
Yeah.
Yeah,
but I think it started, the phrase or the term was coined in New York. So getting rid of Minneapolis's Tenderloin, a.k.a. Skid Row, happens when the federal government, is pumping tons of urban renewal money in.
Yes.
So it was time to make a move. According to Larry Millett, who is a fine author, you know who he is.
Oh, yes.
His latest book, Minnesota Modern, Architecture and Life in Mid-Century, he talks about this this renovation project, which was billed as the biggest urban renewal project in the country at that time.
Yes, at the time, absolutely.
Right. He said, and you've got these similar figures in your book here, James. He says, at one time, the Skid Row was home to 109 bars, 113 hotels and flop houses, and virtually, as you said, all male population, about 3,500 lost souls. Propelled by federal money, the place got cleaned up, destroying 201, some of them historic buildings,
sure,
like the beautiful Metropolitan Building that never should have been torn down. Nearly 550 small businesses vanished in this huge cleanup. Big broom here, sweeping aside some worthy buildings that should have been saved. But let's talk about the human factor. What happens to the vagrants? What happens to the residents of Skid Row?
Yes, that's an.
They don't go into thin air.
That's an excellent question. I mean, when you think about the history of Minneapolis. If people know anything about that part of town, they know about the Metropolitan Building. You know, architectural marvel. That was demolished because it was right on the edge. It wasn't in itself part of the problem, but it was right on the edge of, and it was a building that was in need of repair, and that destruction kind of had sort of gave some energy and sort of created the historic preservation movement. People don't talk as much about what happened to this was a downtown population that is, you know, was there were people living in the heart of downtown, a large group of people that living in the heart of downtown. So the original idea was they were going to house all these guys in one place, elsewhere in the city.
Coming soon to a neighborhood
they
near you.
They could not find any neighborhood willing to take them. They chose nine spots, and there was a sort of an uprising at each one. So they said, well, you know, first of all, we'll do triage. A number of these guys, we'll call them floaters. So they are not like actual. We'll consider them transients. We have no responsibility towards them. There are others who actually have an address. We will encourage them. We'll get some relocation assistance. We'll get somebody to counsel them. And if they find a new place to live and they come back, we'll give them $5.
Oh.
That was
five
the extent,
whole dollars.
That $5. That was the extent of the financial aid that these guys got. So what actually happened to them? there's not really good records of it. There were some places, North Washington Avenue, kind of at North Washington where Broadway is together. A lot of them, there was a number of places there, flop houses and things. There was at Seven Corners where Cedar and Washington come together. There were a number of sort of flop houses there. There was concern about the Nicollet Avenue South, sort of in from Grant Street South to about Franklin, where there was concern that a lot of these people were going. So it was really the only way we know where they went is kind of like where people were freaking out because it seemed like it was turning into Skid Row again.
How is it that places like the Gay 90s and the Copper Squirrel survived?
Well, they were, the Gay 90s was able to move around the corner to a building. And it's like when we've led walking tours of the former Gateway, we start in front of the Gay 90s because it's like there's a little strip there that has Augies and the Brass Rail. It sort of has a little bit of a feeling of Skid Row.
Real flavor.
Yeah, yeah, it has sort of a flavor. So it's there are elements, you know, everybody has always said over the years, like Block E was the last remnant of Skid Row, and they demolished that. And now you have the...
What do you have there now?
Yeah, well, you have the Mayo Clinic, sports clinic, and, you know, the practice facility for the Timberwolves, and now they're talking about putting some other businesses in there. But, you know, there were businesses, there was quite a rush of businesses that were trying to relocate elsewhere in the city, the liquor licenses, and this was quite a, you know, you look at the newspapers from the time, they're dominated by all these stories about, well, you know, Harry Small wants to move his license over here, and there's all these fights over it. So, you know, you can try to stamp out Skid Row, but there is a market for cheap booze and strip joints and cheap places to flop.
Was it a red light district? Was it an area of not so much prostitution?
Well, I mean,
some obviously.
Yeah. Definitely, it was there. No question about it that there was prostitution there. But it was really Skid Row was it was a little, it was somewhat distinct because it was more for kind of the down and out. You know, there were some bars that people from outside the Skid Row would go to. But it was not the same thing as the sort of the sin district that you would think about. Yeah. You know, it was...
Those were blocks away, run by some very astute businesswomen. The madams, well, they were. They were very good. They paid the bribes to the local police and
Absolutely.
City officials, and they ran, in a sense, upstanding businesses, in the sense that they were businesses, and they
Absolutely.
Turned a profit, and they were kept clean.
Yes.
And the clientele, they wore three-piece suits, a lot of these guys, and some of them... I worked at City Hall, too.
Oh,
this is way back when.
Oh, yeah.
So the clientele in Skid Row really didn't have the money anyway to
that level of prostitution was not a big business. It was pretty desperate.
Today we have something called, what, wet houses for problem alcoholics, chronic alcoholics?
Yes, there are a number of nonprofits that run wet houses, which, and the reason I mention them in the book is they are very much the modern version of one of these flop houses, and not in the sense that they are miserable places to live. The conditions, I think, are far better than what you would find in the cage hotels. But sobriety is not required, so that you have what they would call late-stage alcoholics. It's a safe
place. That's a euphemism, saying these guys are on the road to the graveyard.
Yes, but that there is, that they deserve a safe place to live.
Okay.
And that is, it's interesting, that's been a controversial concept, but it is, it is somewhat embraced by society at this point, that there is a place for drugs.
Going back to the day when Skid Row was in full bloom, as it were, the sociology students analysts, they said in their exhaustive research, you say, they determined that in any given moment, about a third of the patrons of Gateway bars, that is Skid Row bars, were visibly drunk.
Yes.
One third. Daylight, nighttime, anytime.
Yes.
Anytime.
Now, so you can imagine going to a bar today if you saw a third of the people were staggering or had their heads on the bar. That would be pretty shocking.
Your epilogue to your book, the book is an amazing read, folks. You've got to get it. The King of Skid Row by James Eli Schiffer, S-H-I-F-F-E-R. The epilogue is very poignant. You, as you've mentioned already, you give walking tours of the old Skid Row area.
Yes.
Are there any vestiges, any relics still around that you can see, touch,
sense? You know, it is almost completely gone. There is... the reason, as I said, we start the walkie tour in front of the Gay 90s in that block is you get a feel of it, although that was not within the Gateway redevelopment area. The destruction was so total that the edges of it are the old Milwaukee Road Railroad Station. Mm-hmm. There's a federal building there, the post office. But you really, it is the only thing that remains is Gateway Park. Mm-hmm. And Gateway Park doesn't even resemble what used to be mm-hmm. there. It's just mm-hmm. a little sliver of a park that no one goes to. And there's the only original piece of it is that flagpole. There is a flagpole. Mm-hmm. That's it. You know, the fact that there is a Whole Foods with a liquor store selling fancy booze on the corner of Washington and Edison shows you how much has changed.
Oh, my. If you've mentioned you give walking tours. Yes. How do we hook up with you? How do we
Well, I will be giving them on behalf of the Star Tribune walking tours of the Gateway District for the first four Thursdays in June. And so look at the paper starting in about May. For more information on that.
In the last couple of minutes, you got to know this guy, Johnny Rex, pretty well.
I did.
Lucky because he was in his 90s when you met him.
He was.
He seemed to trust you. He was a little wary, but he did give you lots of information. His wife, Barbara, they're both gone now.
They are.
But this photo archive that he that landed in your hands, thanks to him, was immeasurable in chronicling this story. What do you make of the guy? He's gone now. Johnny Rex, real name Johnny Bassich. What about him?
Well,
how do you feel about him? What are your feelings?
Well, I mean, I'd say a morally complex figure, you know, sold alcohol to drunks and, you know, was a complicated person. I think he helped preserve a part of the city's history. And I think I'm grateful for that because I think he did recognize it was a real community.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think was a valuable contribution.
Mm-hmm.
Really do.
Okay. What surprised you in doing this book, doing the research?
I was surprised at the how well documented this era was and just the incredible pictures and the stories that remained and how just how a whole community and world existed that is now gone.
When Johnny Rex's joint, the Sourdough Bar, caught fire, not an unusual thing to happen in Skid Row, the fireman confronted him while it was burning and said, "Well, what do you want us to do? Should we put it out or do you just want to let it go?"
And he thought about it, but he didn't have insurance, so he said, "Put it out."
Put it out.
And he got six more months and one more big party.
One more big party.
Ring
the bell.
Ring the bell.
Free drinks.
Absolutely.
Oh man.
I was there.
Yeah. I too. I think I would have enjoyed but it would have been a fascinating look.
Definitely.
A fascinating window on a time now long gone.
Yes.
Wow. Got any more books in the works?
Thinking about it. Can't give it away just yet.
Okay, don't do that. When could we see you? When you're going to be signing some books pretty soon?
Launch event is at the Mill City Museum on April 7th at 7 p.m.
That's not too far from Skid Row, is it?
It's right there.
Right there. That's what I thought. James Eli Schiffer, author of The King of Skid Row, John Bassich, and The Twilight Years of Old Minneapolis. There it is, James. Great job. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Stan.
All right. Have a great weekend, everybody. You got the weather to do it for sure, and we'll see you on the All Request and Dedication program right here on Club 1220 KLBB right after the news at noon this coming Monday. Bye-bye.